The next bill...
...by Senator Meyer, an act relating to the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool. This bill was reported to committee... was referred to committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 113 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments. Ladies and gentlemen, what this has to do with is the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool. Currently, that is for individuals who are high risk because of pre-existing conditions. They cannot get insurance through their regular insurance companies, through private insurance or group insurance. So consequently, we have a system in the state of Wyoming that provides a safety net where for about 130% of the average rate of insurance is they can buy insurance. Right now, there's two offerings. There's a $1,000 deductible offering and there's a $5,000 deductible offering. And the proposal of this bill, as you can see on page 2, is to offer individuals a catastrophic health plan that has a deductible level of $25,000. So this will add a third category of insurance they can purchase. The second thing that the bill does at the top of Little 2 is it has a constraint on those who qualify. And this is it's proposed that this be limited to individuals whose total household income does not exceed 400% of the federal poverty level. It's felt that those who have higher income can afford insurance elsewhere pretty much no matter what the cost. So that's what the bill proposes. I stand for any questions.
Any other questions on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File number 113 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 113 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 31. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 31, introduced by Senator Hines, an act relating to agriculture and animals regarding the brucellosis surveillance program. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Semlek?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that bill... our Senate File number 31 do pass, and there are no standing committee amendments, and I would turn the management of the bill over to the good representative from House District 43.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Representative Swanitzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm pleased to present Senate File 31. Basically, this takes the existing brucellosis surveillance program that we allow vets to come out and check herds for brucellosis, and it allows them to actually vaccinate and spay should they choose to do so. Already, we allow $3.50 up to $8 per head of cattle to be tested. We believe that financially we can also do the spaying and the vaccination within the same price range, so the bill is revenue neutral. It basically just expands if you're going to have someone show up to test your cows and they're at risk, you can actually vaccinate them as well while they're there. And I'd be happy to answer any questions on it.
Are there any questions? Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'm not going to tell you to vote no on this because you didn't listen to me on the last one. But I do think the body should understand a little bit of my perspective as to why I don't think that necessarily the concept of spaying your heifers is a good one for controlling brucellosis. You're in an operation, you either keep your heifers for replacement heifers, which means you're going to have them bred to a bull and you're going to keep them open, or you're going to keep them for market. If you're going to keep them for market and you're going to keep them open, you're not going to breed them. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the state to come in and pay to spay those heifers. They're not going to be bred, and if they're not going to be bred, there's no chance of them spreading brucellosis. So the logic behind spaying heifers doesn't make any sense to me. And if somebody can explain why it does make sense, I haven't had anybody explain it to me yet. And so that's the struggle that I have with this bill.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. First, I would like to point out on line 14, this is only in the designated surveillance areas defined by the Livestock Board. As the good chairman knows, there's a handout in everyone's desk with your district's name on it that does show you what the surveillance area is. And this is really at the discretion of that rancher if he feels that he is in a part of an area that this needs to be done in order to safeguard his cows. He should be allowed to do this. A bill we discussed in the interim, and I had questions at that time how much it costs to spay a heifer. It isn't that much, and everybody firmly told me that it's already being done. It's easily within $8. It's a very simple procedure, and there really wasn't any disagreement with this bill up until now. So I'd still ask you to vote yes on it. Thank you.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Try to answer the question in regard to the spraying issue. These cattle will likely be run in areas in permits where there'll be other cattle present. While it might be the intention of the owner of the spay of the heifers to keep them open, therefore not spay them, certainly in those multiple pasture breeding situations, you don't have that ability to control that because you're in there on the permit with other owners who have a management plan to spay them heifers or to breed their heifers, so they'll have bulls in there, and therefore these heifers will get bred. So spaying them, I tell you, if every intact or every female in that brucellosis control area was spayed, that would take care of the brucellosis problem. Now, I'm not so unrealistic to believe that will ever happen. I'm just telling you this is just another tool where we could take a certain segment of the cattle that could be exposed up there and take them out of the equation of saying these cattle, if they're spayed, they will no longer be involved in this. If we can do that with a few hundred head of cattle, it would certainly be worth it. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Teeters.
And I'm not up here to argue with the good chairman, who I agree with most of the time, but I do not understand the logic of if you're going to run your cattle in an allotment and your intention is to run them as market cattle, then you're going to spay them anyway. Okay? So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I don't think this is going to do anything to help solve our brucellosis problem. I guess if the body thinks there's a chance that it will, go ahead and support it. And the vaccination part of this bill does make sense to me. If you're going to vaccinate them, but the spaying thing, it just the line of logic is just too thin for me. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? Question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Semlick's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File Number 31 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 31 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 117. The reading clerk will
Madam
read the
Chairman.
Bill. Ah, there you are.
Bleach of the floor.
Go ahead, Representative Hales.
Thank you. In the south balcony from Casper, we have representatives of the Boys and Girls Club representing over 10,000 youth served by the Boys and Girls Club of Wyoming. Dominic Mestis, a 10-year member and a senior at Kelly Walsh High School, was named Wyoming's State Youth of the Year today at a noon luncheon. Dominic will receive a full tuition education to the University of Wyoming plus $1,000 from the Reader's Digest. She will represent our state in a regional competition in June in Texas. And Dominic's accompanied by her mother, Dana, and her sister Maria, and Ashley Bright, who is the director. Give them a big Wyoming welcome.
Dominique, congratulations. Dana, Maria, and Ashley, welcome to the House. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 117. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 117, introduced by Senator Scott, an act relating to the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Escobel, Goggles, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson, No, Davis, and Hallinan. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 117 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I hand over the explanation of the bill to the good representative from the Great Basin Country.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senate File 117 may seem to you that it is similar to Senate File 113 that we just passed, but this is a little different. This is for people who may be eligible for a private health insurance plan or a company health insurance plan, but the premium far exceeds what the premium for the high-risk pool premium is. And just to tell you a little bit about the health insurance pool, it is not an entitlement, and the rates for that insurance plan run about 127% of the market. So it is expensive to be a part of the health insurance pool, but this adds a second level to that. And these are for people, like I said, they do have insurance eligibility elsewhere, but it is at a very high cost. It's very rare circumstances. And let me just give you one example. An older couple gets married. He's still working, and he is Medicare eligible. So he doesn't subscribe to his group health insurance from his work. His new wife does not have health insurance, so she has nothing that's portable to come with her to bring her into that plan. In this gentleman's plan, the spouse or the family coverage is the employee pays 100%. That would be one instance where the insurance would be extremely high for the wife to be insured. And they do have the opportunity to be in this pool. This would authorize them to be in this pool. And if you go to page 2, line 3, this is where the authorization says, even though the employer coverage is declined, unless the cost to insure the individual is offered at a rate to the individual or his employed family member exceeding the applicable pool rate for the coverage applied for under the pool. Now, one of the benefits that could happen to our, and this is, again, it could happen to the high-risk pool, is that if this is a healthy person coming in, it does help with the adverse selection. It's a very rare circumstance that this happens, but we still have people that are seeking to get health insurance and because of the cost, it becomes exorbitant, and they have to choose between health insurance and other things. In the long run, this really does help the state. We may bring them into the pool. However, it helps the state by not having them be uninsured. And with that, Madam Chairman, I would stand for questions.
Are there any questions? We have two Committee of the Whole amendments. Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I would like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 117 and ask for your favorable consideration. After passing this bill through committee, we knew there was a few of us that had some concerns that this would open it up, the pool up to too many people. I mean, we want to encourage people to use their employer coverage if at all possible. But there are a few instances where the employer coverage is just out of line, it's astronomical in its cost, and so we thought we would put a disclaimer in there that basically, if your employer coverage is at least 20% higher than what it would be in the pool, then you can opt into the pool. And that's what this amendment was doing, and I would stand for any questions.
Representative Harvey.
Madam Chairman, I would consider this a friendly amendment, I guess because I'm on it.
Are there any other questions? Are we ready for the question? We are on Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole, Number 1 has passed. We are on Committee of the Whole, Number 2. Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 2 to House Bill Number 117, and I request your favorable consideration of it. This amendment would... See, there's a limit on the number of people that can be insured in this pool, and that's determined by the amount of the subsidy that's put in from the taxation of the insurance companies and the $3 million annually that we put in here annually. So every year the actuaries are supposed to estimate how many people they're going to be able to cover. The losses for each one of the insureds are about 200% of the amount of premium that is derived from them, even though we charge them higher than the standard rate. So what this amendment does, it changes, it allows the department to continue to give policies to folks that have other options, even if they're higher priced. It allows them to continue to do that. But when the number of people reach 95% of that maximum number, with this amendment, it cuts off the insurance offerings to those folks who have the option of insurance elsewhere. In other words, it reserves that 5% of those number of slots for people that don't have another option. So that's the amendment, and if anybody has a question for me, I'd be happy to answer it.
Are there any questions? Question having been called, we are on Committee of the Whole, Number 2. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole, Number 2 has passed. Are there any other questions on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 117 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 117 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 21. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 21, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to subdivisions located within irrigation districts. This file was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Zwanitzer-Dan. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Semlek?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 21 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Madam Chairman, members of the House, I will talk about that amendment as we go through the bill. This Senate File 21, it goes into the county roads statutes in 18 and in the planning and zoning part in Article 5, and it adds an additional consideration for the minimum requirements for subdivision permits. We have had more than one of these bills that we've considered this year that go back into the county planning and zoning, and part of the reason we're doing that is because of the changing face of Wyoming and the development that we see out in the areas of the state that we normally haven't had before. And this is a bill to address an additional problem that we've had out there for several years. And what it will do, if you pick up on page 2, starting in section F there, it says that if a subdivision is located within, and then you pick up the first part of the amendment there, if the subdivision is located within the boundaries of an irrigation district that is subject to the provisions of Title 41, Chapter 7, which is the irrigation districts and the water, in the water statutes, of the Wyoming statutes. The application shall, and then we pick up another section in the amendment that said on page 3, line 1, and on line 7 of the amendment, it will further read, the application shall include a review and recommendation from the irrigation district regarding the attached water rights and the irrigation district's easements. The review and recommendation shall be completed by the irrigation district within 60 days of initial contact from the subdivider unless good cause for the extension is shown by the irrigation district. So that's the amendment to the bill that kind of further clarifies that language of what we want to try to accomplish here. And what's happened over the past few years is that the subdivisions have showed up out on these lands where there is, it necessarily don't have to be an irrigation district there, but there is maybe a ditch or something that was used by an irrigation district that goes through the subdivision. Then it becomes a question of trying to determine how do we deal with some of those situations out there with people who are not really all that familiar with irrigation. And this bill just really attempts to preempt some of those problems that we've had out there to identify before a subdivision plan is approved to say if it occurs within an irrigation district and these are the things that we need to do, we allow the subdivider and the irrigation district folks to get together, talk about what it is, and then on further on down the bill in Section G, it talks about the significant burden or the risk of liability. I would say this is principally in regard to like an irrigation canal or something that goes through a subdivision. How are we going to deal with that burden of risk or liability or responsibility? And I will tell you that organization that represents the county governments across Wyoming and the organization that represents the folks that develop land within Wyoming both approve and support this Senate file.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't have a real clear understanding of what's expected from the ditch company. A review and recommendation. A review of what? And recommendations about what? And let me explain what I understand the problem to be, because I'm not even sure I understand what the problem is that was brought to your committee or the committee and was needing to be addressed. But let me describe a problem in our part of the country. A subdivision will crop up on a piece of formerly unsubdivided irrigated land, and it'll have of course it has a gate number or a point of where the water comes out of the main gate or main ditch usually, and then it'll flow down through some other network of ditches, and then it'll arrive at the subdivided ground. And so before, whenever that owner had that piece of ground, he would call the ditch rider, and he would say that he would like, you know, so much reservoir water or whatever turned in, and the ditch rider would say, okay, it'll be, I'll do that Thursday morning or something, and it'll be down at your place by about 10 o'clock. And maybe he has 40 acres. And so maybe the ditch rider would leave the water on for 10 days or something. Well, now that 40 acres has been divided into 20 pieces of property, each piece of property has a small portion of the original water right, and one of the property owners calls the ditch rider and says, "I'd like you to release my water down into the and so that I could water my horse pasture out back or whatever now." And the ditch rider says, "Well, you know, there's not enough water hardly to get the ditch wet just to do one portion, much less, you can have water for half a day, whereas before it may have been for 10 days. And he doesn't even, you can't even get it turned on and off except for you have to have enough water to fill it up for 4 days or something." So I guess I think that this is a problem that needs fixed. But I think that it needs somehow to assign that same water right to it has to stay with the land, so that's okay. But somehow the homeowners association has to be required to designate somebody to call for the water.
Madam Chairman.
Interruption.
We have to building. We have been notified there is smoke in the building. So if you would please proceed down the main stairs. Just take whatever you have on your backs. Don't grab equipment. Don't grab anything. Just evacuate the building. And if we can gather over in the Herschler building in the lobby so we can have a head count. Thank you.
Good thing this building has those early detection fire alarms.
Committee of the Whole will now come to order. We are presently on Senate File 21, and I believe when we left, Chairman Landon was at the mic. Chairman Landon?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's entirely fitting that we have a fire drill during the discussion of a water bill. It did provide an opportunity to have an interim study with the good chairman of the committee. And I think the bill is focusing on something that needs to happen, and that is an awareness by an irrigation district of a subdivision being located within the district and having some conversation ahead of that time before that proposal goes before the county commissioners. I don't know how to micromanage this, but I'm for the bill and for the amendment, and I'm going to leave it at that because I know there's lots of problems happen because a lot of times the delivery ditches are right along the high ground, and that's where people want to build their houses, and it can make for a very confusing a lot of bad feelings and a lot of misunderstandings by other people within the subdivision, and the irrigation district people are expected to straighten it out. So hopefully this will prevent some of that.
Madam Majority Whip.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess I don't have a question on the amendment, but I do have a question on a part of the bill, so I don't know if you want me to wait, finish addressing the amendment, Madam Chairman, or ask my question now.
Chairman Semlick.
Madam Chairman, if there are no further questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, at this time I would ask that the question.
Are we ready for the question on Standing Commitment, Representative Patton?
I do have a question, and the question is how this fits into a county that has gone through and placed and established the zoning and the planning regulations that include areas for subdivisions. And so how does this process fit into it? Do they have to start all over again, or can that be done in advance?
Chairman Semlick.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman, and that is a good question, and it certainly would be something that would be concerning if we didn't have the caveat that this proposal, if passed, will begin at this point and go forward. It won't have any effect on those subdivisions. Perhaps that wasn't exactly the question, but let me try to further explain maybe what the good representative from Sheridan County is talking about. If you have a county land use plan in effect, you get the irrigation district and you get the subdivider together. They've got 60 days to work out this problem. I would assume then that those recommendations that those two entities came together with would go to the Planning Commission. And then the Planning Commission can take a look at that, and their recommendations then could go on to the Board of County Commissioners, who has the final say. So I don't think it interrupts the process any. It allows them to continue to be involved in the process. And then, any concerns there on the part of the irrigation district in regard to the development on these lots could really be dealt with through some kind of a deed restriction or some other stipulation in the agreement when the people purchase these lots and say, if we have an active ditch running through this property, you can't fill it up with dirt or throw logs in it or whatever. So I think it's like we do with a lot of the other recommendations and reviews that occur in the subdivision plan, is it just allows these entities to get together to try to resolve some problems that are currently haven't been dealt with subsequently later, and then it just creates a lot more difficulties.
We are on Standing Committee Amendment number one. Any further questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Are we ready for the question? Questioning having been called, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Childers.
Well, Madam Chairman, I commend the Agriculture Committee for bringing this, having had lots of problems with the irrigation issues and talking to lots of irrigation districts and subdivisions with problems with irrigation problems. What we're attempting to do with the House bill that's over on the other end is addressing that some, bringing irrigation under the county attorney's purview, but they already somewhat have that, and this just strengthens what should be taking place with the developer in the irrigation districts now, and I hope it resolves a lot of the problems. I just wished it had been there 40 years ago. And Madam Chairman, I hate to interrupt this bill being debated, but since I am required to make notice on a committee announcement before 3:00 and we have things coming up first in the morning, if I may just make a revised announcement on my meeting so I'm under the proper time frame.
Chairman Childers, proceed.
Yes, I had announced Committee number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will be hearing three bills in the morning. we will actually hear for sure Senate File 16, State Butterfly, at 8 o'clock. And if time allows, we will hear the other two bills, Senate File 6, Wyoming Arts Council Revisions, and Senate File 14, State Historic Site Appropriations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Childers. Madam Majority Whip?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I do have one question, and it's on page 2 in subsection D. Actually, I have a couple of questions. I'm wondering if the good sponsors of the bill can explain to me why they added in the language on line 15, or crossed by a ditch. And I'd like to know how that is different than an unorganized ditch. So if you could draw that distinction for me, those two. I guess I have those two questions. And then I noticed that the language, or crossed by a ditch, then does not flow at all into sections F or G. It's just like it's totally left out. So I don't know how that, or crossed by a ditch, how that's different than an unorganized ditch, and then why that doesn't flow into sections F and G. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A good representative from Warland Country. We're on the fly here in the corner trying to figure this out, and I'm not sure that we're going to, but by the time, maybe an explanation would simply be, and I think this is true, and I don't mean to dodge the question, is that amendment was put on in the Senate, and I wasn't there to hear that rationale for that, but I will try to ascertain why that was done and get that question answered.
My apologies to the body. Chairman Lockhart, with your announcement, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to announce that your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow morning at 7:30, H18, to hear Senate Joint Resolution 5, Hydraulic Fracturing, and Senate File 85, Cooperative Electric Rate Regulation.
Chairman McComey. Representative Zwanzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. While we're taking a moment out, if I could have a privilege of the floor. Thank you, members of the body. If you look in my right, the South Gallery, one of the commissions of this body that I serve on is the Wyoming Workforce Development Council. We actually are having a meeting here in Cheyenne of the Workforce Development Council. Many of you will see people from your districts from around the state who are leaders in business and industry. In the South Gallery, if they would stand up, and please welcome them and give them a hand.
Members, welcome to the House. Are there any other discussions on Senate File 21? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, this bill is a bill that's probably long been needed. Some of the questions that the good lady from Thermopolis asked about a ditch and an unorganized ditch, we've run into these issues before. My take of a ditch is a ditch that is really an irrigation ditch. An unorganized ditch is a draw or something like that, something that catches wastewater. But that aside, the big thing about this is they're going to get together. One of the things that used to happen, somebody put a pipe in a ditch. Well, the pipe wasn't big enough to carry the amount of flow of the water. There was all kinds of different things always was happening that was in the way. Nobody would look at what kind of a flood you might have, so that this unorganized ditch would wind up with a 18-inch pipe in it and had drainage enough that if you got a fast melt or a good rainstorm, why, you'd flood all the buildings that were there because the water couldn't get through the pipe. So these are all very, very, very good things that I see in this bill, and I rise on in support of it. Thank you very much.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is just an excellent bill. Doesn't solve all the problems, but it's sure a step in the right direction. As these new subdivisions come in and the water comes out, as the good chairman has explained, the water goes to the ditch that leads into the subdivision. Most of the people that buy in the subdivisions don't have any idea what a second foot of water is. And if you have 35 acres and you divide that into seven parts, they have 5 acres, so they have 570th of a foot of water. And it just doesn't, they just don't understand that. So I really think there's a step in the right direction to let the subdivisions, the homeowners association, take care of their problem. And it doesn't really disassociate the state engineer's water responsibility, but I think it sure lessens it. And as a former ditch rider, this is a way good thing to have in there. So I think we're headed in the right direction, would support it.
Is there any other discussion on Senate File 21? Are we ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Semlich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File Number 21 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 21 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next.
Madam Chair, please move Senate File 53 to the bottom of your list. Thank you.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 86. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 86, introduced by Representative or by Senator Perkins, an act relating to anatomical gifts, revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes: Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representing Gingrey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 86 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And just to tell you the Standing Committee Amendment real quick, it's over on page 42. This had to do more with a conflict between an elected official, the coroner, dealing with a private organization, and how it was worded was sort of the private company sort of could trump the elected coroner in his investigation. So we took some of that language out, and then we renumbered everything. And unless there's any questions on that particular section, I'd ask for an aye on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Are you ready for the question? We're on Standing Committee Amendment number one. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
And I would turn over the explanation of the bill to the good gentleman from Casper.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you, you have the Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. I had tried to convince them to call it the Parts as Parts Act, but they refused to do so. But we will we'll walk through this a little bit. The current act that we use in the state of Wyoming is based on the version of the Uniform Act from 1968. And so it's sort of become outmoded in the way that this is handled today. And the new act, this act actually repeals the entire former act, and this is based on the 2006 Model Act. And as a policy matter, this act encourages donation more. It's set up to more easily facilitate donation, whereas the old act made it a little bit more difficult to do donation. The just walking through the act, the first several pages are definitions, and there's a couple of significant new definitions. One is agent, because it defines who an agent of a donor is. One is organ procurement organization, and that talks about basically the tissue transfer centers that you would typically think of. And then the other important definition is reasonably available. This act allows that in the event that a donation isn't made prior to death, certain representatives can make those donations after death.
And there's a hierarchy set for who can make those donations and who gets basically to make the ultimate decision. And the reasonable available ties into that because you don't have to go track down everybody, every brother, sister, mother, father, uncle, aunt on the list. You only have to look at those who are reasonably available, those that you can contact without undue effort. Pages 9 through 10 set out the mechanism for a gift prior to death, and the actual donor can make the that donation, or their if it's a minor, their parent can do that. Gift can be made in a number of different ways, and this is outlined on pages 10 and 12. It can be made in writing. It can be made through a symbol on your driver's license. During a terminal illness, it can be made through any form of communication. It just has to be witnessed by two adults, one of whom is impartial and disinterested. And then the way the bill's set up is you have that structure for making the donation, and then in pages 12 through 14, that same structure is utilized to either amend or revoke the donation. And then on pages 14 and 16, that exact same structure is set up so that you can refuse to donate. And so what can happen is if you during your life don't want someone upon your death to donate any of your organs, you can make a refusal during your lifetime, and you just do it in the same way as you would typically do a donation, and that has to be honored after your death. There, pages 16 through 19 sets up some good language that resolves conflicts between different documents. For example, if you've got a donative intent, a clear document, but maybe your healthcare power of attorney conflicts with it, it sets that up. It sets up hierarchies among, for example, parents versus child, who gets the say in who can make the donation. Pages 19 through 21 talks about the hierarchy of those folks that can make a donation for you upon your death. And you can see 19, for example, spouse is first priority. Ultimately, they get the final say, and it kind of goes down from their adult children, et cetera, et cetera. And so it sets out a clear guideline on who can make that decision after a decedent's death. On pages 23 through 27, section 35.5.211, it sets up limitations on who can receive donations. You're talking hospitals, medical schools, procurement organizations, and research facilities. And it sets a general policy that we're going to favor donation over basically giving it for research, for example, cadaver study. Pages 27 through 31 sets up a mechanism for if a document is delivered after death, a donative document is delivered after death. Pages 31 through 33, sections 216 through 218 sets up criminal sanctions for selling body parts. And then 34 through 37, section 219 charges the Department of Transportation for setting up a registry. And that's sort of a general, very quick walkthrough on the bill. The one thing this does is the people of Wyoming, typically when they're giving donations, they're doing it in the large medical centers outside the state. And this puts us more in line with those the laws of those states to our south and to our west where a lot of these donations take place. So it really is a good step in facilitating donations and make sure that the donor's intent is consistently interpreted and that the rules of the road are fairly clear. So with that quick discussion, I'd take any questions.
We are on committee of the whole amendment number one. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move committee of the whole amendment number one. What this one does, if you remember the standing committee amendment, on page 42, line 12, we had switched allow to deny, And then it was pointed out to me by the LSO attorneys that I sort of didn't need to say both, allow or deny, for grammatical reasons, I guess. I'm not sure. I couldn't quite remember why. Yeah, I think that's what it was. So anyway, so instead of just deny, it was allow or deny. So that was what the amendment was.
Are there any questions on Committee of the Whole number one? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole number one has passed. We are back on the bill. Are there any questions on the bill? Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess I got a couple of questions. As I read page 14, it says one can refuse donation. Is there any risk under the language as it's written for people to potentially do involuntary donations? And In addition, I guess I'd like to suggest that, you know, back in 2003 and then again in 2005, we made changes affecting the end-of-life directives, and I kind of feel like we made a little bit of a mess out of it. In my last check, there seemed to be inconsistencies and confusing policies. And I just wonder, how does this dovetail with the end-of-life directives? And in addition, I'd say that it seems to me like this bill looks fairly broad, and I guess I'm wondering, was there any consideration for an interim study on this to try to do a thorough review of all end-of-life directives? And a technician is who's qualified can remove the parts needed, and I see that's mentioned under the definitions. But I guess from my own knowledge, how would I find where those qualifications are? It seems to me like a lot of the language in this is pretty broad, and I guess I'm a little nervous about this particular piece of legislation. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to answer those as best as I can. As far as an interim study, I don't believe there was a discussion to handle it during an interim study. This was brought to us through the donative agencies that operate in the state of Wyoming, and was sort of a ongoing process throughout the interim. The question on end-of-life directives and how this interfaces with those, I think this actually clarifies a lot of that confusion. And there is, see if I can find it for you real quick. There are a couple of different provisions within the, if you look at pages 37 through 39, and this is section 35.5.220, it sort of sets out and provides some guidance if there's conflicts between advanced health care directive, like if you have an anatomical gift declaration on your health care directive, and then you have a separate one, it sets out the priorities of those. So I think this bill actually goes a long way towards curing some of those areas of confusion that can arise as a result of maybe somebody not paying as much attention to those documents as they should. And the comment about the breadth of the bill and the risk of giving a involuntary donation, it is a very broad bill, and there could be an involuntary donation if you, as a potential donor, don't do anything to make your intentions known, if you don't do a refusal, if you don't do anything to make your intentions known, and then after your death, any of those folks, for example, your spouse, your children, those folks that are listed in the hierarchy, make a decision to go ahead and allow a donation of one of your organs. So that can happen, and that policy I was talking about at the outset, that this leans in favor of donation of organs. It basically says if you're not going to, if you want to refuse to make those organ donations, you need to make that intent known. And if you do, then those folks on the hierarchy, they can't override that if you do that during life. But if you don't make your intentions known during life, then they are free to make donations after your death.
Are there any other questions? Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate that explanation. However, I would challenge you to go to your local hospital and try to go through the routine of preparing for end-of-life directives and just find out where you end up and then compare what the policies are compared to our state statutes. I think you might be surprised. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Are there any other questions on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate file number 86 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate file 86 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate file 70. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate file 70, introduced by Senator Case, an act relating to crimes and criminal procedure regarding loss of firearm rights protections. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, representing Begbie, Vice Chair.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Gingrey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate file number 70 do pass. And I can go ahead and give you the explanation of the bill. If you look at who the sponsor is on from the other house, he did a bill a few years ago trying to allow people that had been convicted of certain types of crimes to regain their firearms rights. That went to the Tenth Circuit. It was rejected that we couldn't do that. So you've seen there's been a few different bills this session trying to do some things dealing with that subject matter. And this is just another one of those bills. Here is what this bill is attempting to do. It's doing two different things. The first thing it's doing is saying that when the judge is advising someone of their rights, and at the very beginning, when you first come in before the judge goes through a whole litany of different rights that you have as a defendant. And this would just be another one of those statements that the judge would have to make. And what the judge has to say is, and it's only for those particular crimes where this would have effect, is that by pleading guilty to this crime, that the individual may lose their firearms rights pursuant to what's normally referred to as the Lautenberg Amendments. And these are federal laws under the Violence Against Women Act that if you commit certain crimes, you cannot possess firearms ever again. And so all this is saying is the judge is telling the defendant, just be aware that, you know, before you plead guilty, that you understand that you're probably going to lose your firearms rights, so you understand the gravity of the crime you're pleading to. From our understanding is, we actually couldn't find any judge that's not doing this, but so it's more codifying what seems to already be happening in the court system anyway. So the judge needs to tell them, number one, by pleading guilty to this, you may lose your firearms rights. And then you'll see there in Romanet 2 on line 10, he also has to tell them if they are a peace officer, a member of the armed forces, a hunting guide, security guard, or engaged in any other profession or occupation requiring the carrying of a firearm, that you may lose your profession or occupation. Again, the purpose is so that the person understands the gravity of what they're about to plead to, so that so that at a later date they don't suddenly go, well, gosh, it was explained to me, it was just a minor charge, I just need to pay the fine and go home. I didn't realize that there was going to be these major ramifications to my pleading. The Section 2 part, what that's dealing with is saying that if you are charged under 62501, which is domestic violence, if you're charged under that, that you are you qualify to get a defense attorney if you can't afford one, so a public defender. Again, it was our understanding this actually is going on in most cases. So, because one of our questions in committee was, will this impact the public defender's office? And it looked like it won't, because they're already doing it. So again, it seems to be codifying what's already in practice. And I'd stand for any questions on it.
We do have a standing committee amendment. Vice Chairman Bagby.
Madam Chairwoman, I move Amendment number 1 to House Bill 70. And stand for questions.
Vice Chair Bagby, do you want to explain the standing committee amendment?
I do. If you go to page 3, line 20, what we did was we deleted July 1st, 2009, and we want to make this bill effective immediately, Madam Chairman.
Any other discussion on the standing committee amendment? Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing committee amendment 1 has passed. We are back on the bill, and I believe we have a committee of the whole amendment. Chairman Gingrey.
I apologize, Madam Chair. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 it just simply had the wrong numbers in there. If you look on page 2, line 3, and again on line 8, it was saying Title 18 of the U.S. Code, and it was saying 922G9, and it's actually 922G1. And so that's what it was doing there.
We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 has passed. We are back on the bill. Are there any other questions? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate file number 70 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate file 70 has passed. The Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate file number 29. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 29, introduced by Senator Geis, an act relating to the industrial road program limits. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 29 do pass. For the explanation of the bill is that we, on this, have raised the limits to be more closer related to actual costs. If you look at the bill, it raises it from $1 million to $2 million that can participate. And so they can get a little bit more done with those funds. It doesn't add any more money to the profile. It just makes it more usable. And if there's not further questions, I'd ask for a vote on the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File number 29 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 29 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 11. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 11, introduced by Senator Burns, an act relating to state parks and historic sites and dealing with ranger authority. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Childers.
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 11, Senate File 11, do pass. And I will turn the explanation over to the good representative from District 14.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairwoman, this bill makes a small extension of the authority of state rangers and state parks. A few years ago, we made them peace officers, those are magic words in our statutes, and a peace officer has to have gone to the law enforcement academy and done all his things to qualify to be a person who can enforce the law. Sheriff's deputies, policemen, highway patrolmen, all those people go to the law enforcement academy, and they are all peace officers. We made our full-time park rangers in state parks peace officers, and wait a minute now. Right. And while they're within the boundaries of the state park, and we want to add to that recreation areas and archaeological sites. They don't have any jurisdiction off premises. Their jurisdiction stops at the boundary of the particular area of the park or archaeological site or recreation area, as the case may be, unless there's a request for assistance from another jurisdiction outside the park. So this is a simple, these are the same people, the same kind of people that have the same training as park rangers in state parks, and we just want to add our people that work, who are properly qualified, who work in recreation areas and archaeological sites. And so with that explanation, Madam Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What could you give me a definition of what a recreational area is? Because that's the boundaries where the they would be. And how is a recreational defined area defined with a boundary?
Representative Brown?
No. Chairwoman, I would have it by the next reading. That's the best I can do, and I'd be happy to do that.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Same question, except on the archaeology sites. Some examples of where these are in Wyoming. You know, we have all the state parks, you know, what that are covered by this now, and we're adding these two entities. I'd just like to know what they are and where they are.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairwoman, I'll see if I can get you a formal definition, but one would be Legend Rock. That is an archaeological site. And certainly those are sites where we desperately need somebody who has law enforcement authority on site. There's a lot of very valuable things to protect there.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Madam Chairman, even though there may be a gray area where a boundary is on a recreation area or an archaeological site, the whole problem with the people is they had to go, when they reached the boundary, they had to stop. They couldn't continue the chase, if that's what people are trying to understand.
Representative Brown.
Well, and Madam Chairwoman, I just might add in response to that, these people are peace officers, and when we considered this in committee, I explored with these people whether their jurisdiction stops at the state park boundary in the case of state park rangers. And they said, yes, it does. And I said, so you're going through the trees in the dark at 100 miles an hour chasing somebody, and if you can't get a hold of a sheriff's deputy on the radio and be invited to assist when they hit the park boundary, you got to stop. And they said, yes. And I said, I don't like that. These people are peace officers. They have certain powers, and they're qualified, and I don't know why they stop at the park boundary. So I think we're going to take a look at that during the interim.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that last point, I if we're looking into that, I mean, you're going to be opening up, are we going to expand municipalities? Because their powers stop at the borders, too. So I think that's a bigger topic than maybe just start state park rangers. In regards to recreation areas and archaeological site, what I want to make sure is somewhere in the rules or somewhere in the statutes that's actually defined, because, I mean, I might have a little archaeological site in my backyard. Does that mean he now has authority in my backyard? And recreation area, I mean, if I walk across the street and, I don't know, recreate over there, can the state park guy come now and enforce something? I want to make sure that, I think we know what a state park is. That's defined. I want to make sure that these are actual definitions of a particular area officially designated by the state of Wyoming as a recreation area, not just simply that any archaeological site, the state park guy can show up and start enforcing, you know, whatever they enforce.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairwoman, there is one distinction, and I think it's going to take some interim study, but these guys tell me, they told us in the committee meeting, I brought up the fact that a town policeman has a right of hot pursuit outside the town, and they claim that they don't. And I don't quite understand that, and the last speaker will be a big help to me in figuring that out. But there's something tangled up there that we need. The other thing that a representative from Washakie County was just kind enough to help me with is we do have one recreation area called, I don't know whether I want to say his name. We do have a recreation area. You can find it on the web. It's got something to do with birds.
Chairman Childers.
Madam Chairman, ignore my previous comments. I am here. My brain wasn't.
Chairman Childers considered it ignored. Any other discussion on the Senate file? Question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Childen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 11 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 58. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 58, introduced by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to vehicle title and registration. This Senate file was passed through the Transportation Committee, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Hallinan, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Swanitzer, Dave, signed Representative Cohey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I move that when Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 58 do pass. There also is a standing committee amendment, and I urge your adoption of standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 58 at this time. Madam Chairwoman, what standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 58 does is goes into the bill, page 2, line 2, where it mentions act that was amended to read the word, or where it says article, it was amended to read the word, act was amended to read the word article as these are only amendments or changes to an original act of law. On page 2, line 16, it amends the original language to enhance a definition of a commercial vehicle and how it relates to other statutory citations in Wyoming statute. In page 40, line 20, it further defines how an out-of-state operator of a commercial vehicle will be assessed for operations in this state. And then on page 40, line 11, it's just a technical correction to remove the word not as the discussion of the registration permit was to be a discussion about an operator, not the reverse to be true. So, Madam Chairman, I so move adoption of Standing Committee Amendment number 1.
We're on Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Over the past 2 or 3 years in Wyoming, a large increase in alternative types of vehicles being manufactured even around the world and marketed and sold to citizens in Wyoming. And examples would include mini motorcycles, three-wheel motorcycles, small, very small cars, etc. People are also restoring older vehicles that may not have been registered or even titled in Wyoming for many, many years. Many times people have attempted to title and register these vehicles without traditional forms of proof of ownership. Many telephone calls resulting from the county clerks, treasurers, and YDOT have been occurring almost on a daily basis on how to deal with these various types of vehicles and ownership documents. There's been a tremendous amount of confusion and inconsistency on how to title and register vehicles during this same time frame. Wyoming statutes concerning title and registration currently on our books been enacted in a more stable and traditional time period, and are not exactly clear enough to adequately resolve a whole lot of these issues. Previously, new wording or maybe even a paragraph was added to the statutes to address a special vehicle or license place as it came up that particular year. Over time, the new language created some confusion and repeated similar language already in the law that maybe should not have been added. That process led to a partnership with county clerks, treasurers, YDOT, and affected association groups, and they decided to form an ad hoc committee to look at what they called mutual items of interest concerning these confusions and inconsistencies. The diverse committee met in late 07, early 08, and many times since then, resulting in thousands and thousands of hours of public-private partnership concerning the mutual items of interest. The main mutual items of interest identified were a general lack of consistency in current statutes, ambiguous definitions and language in current statutes, fragmented and or unorganized sections making statutes hard to follow and read, to increase accountability obtaining titles and registration, however at the same time to allow more flexibility for officials and citizens involved in the process and to allow for technological advances such as electronic titling, lien filings, and registrations as an option. Madam Chairman, the bill as amended creates a more streamlined and equitable process in all 23 counties. I urge your adoption and stand for questions.
Any other discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Cohey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File Number 58 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 58 is passed, Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 110. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 110, introduced by Senator Bebout, an act relating to real estate licensees, designated real estate agents. This bill, this file was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne, excused, Mercer, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 110 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and I will turn over the explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill to the good gentleman from Albany County.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairwoman, a little bit of background about why this bill is here, and a couple of things I found quite interesting. Prior to 1996, we really didn't have any statutes that defined the relationship between buyers and their real estate agents, or sellers and their real estate agents. And I have some material here that indicates in 1983, the Federal Trade Commission did a survey of potential buyers of real property and found that 72% thought the real estate practitioner was working with them was working for them. Now, what's the difference between working with and working for? Working with simply means that there's some sort of a customer or somebody that is showing them the property, but people thought, 72% of the people thought that agent was working for them. And in fact, that agent was working for the seller and not for them. There was a lot of confusion amongst buyers about what their status was. And frankly, in some of these real estate transactions, buyers did not fare very well. So in 1997, Wyoming passed the Brokerage Relationship Act. And for the first time, we tried to talk about the law of agency. And that's what this is the law of agency. And who is an agent for whom? Who has responsibilities to whom? And how is this issue of vicarious liability being handled. We've now struggled and limped along with that for 10 years, and I think this 10 years of experience has shown that it's needed, but it also exposed the weaknesses in that initial law. In addition, we have one of our major communities that has, this is interesting because this really goes to the essence of the bill, one of our communities that has the largest ski area in the state now has only one real estate agency with something in the order of 75 to 100 agents in it. So here's the problem in a nutshell. You go to that community to buy a house, and you want a real estate agent to show you property, and you want that agent to work on your behalf and in your best interest. They're unable to do that in almost all cases because that real estate agency has already listed the property as a seller. So under the old statute, they have to default out of being an agent for the seller and an agent for the buyer, and they have to default in to a middle position, which is being an intermediary. And an intermediary doesn't represent either party, just tries to provide both parties with information and try to be neutral about it. And it's an unsatisfactory situation. And we find that lots of buyers and lots of sellers are calling the real estate commission and saying, I don't understand this intermediary business, and I don't understand why I can't have a real estate agent that's working in my best interest. So this bill has been in the cooker for a number of years. I think it's been through the Minerals Committee twice. There's been a lot of refinement. There's been a lot of discussion amongst realtors in the state. And I think all the real estate organizations are now in agreement on this bill, and most of the realtors, although I don't think all, but nearly all. So this changes the basic playing field, but it's the same game. And it goes this way, that there can be a designated, well, and one more thing in that Real Estate Act of 1997 said the same thing that basically that law firms are bound by, that if one person in that agency represents someone, then everybody is in the same position, and they would have a conflict of interest with anyone else. That's the problem in the large community. So this changes, as I say, it changes the way things are done, but it's basically the same game. And what it says is you can have an agent who's what it calls a designated agent and has designated agency with either a seller or a buyer. That becomes more of a personal responsibility of that particular real estate agent. And then in the same real estate firm, you can have another agent who is a designated agent for the other party to the transaction, so that if a real estate agency has a listing, they are not precluded by virtue of listing the property on behalf of the seller from representing a buyer except in an intermediary capacity. That someone in that agency can continue to be the seller's agent, and somebody in that agency can be the buyer's agent. And there is a supervising broker that's always in charge of that. It then brings in one more concept that's interesting and says, well, there's got to be somebody that's the umbrella that's managing this transaction. Well, what if the managing broker in the agency is one of the designated agents, either for the seller or the buyer? Then who's going to oversee the transaction and make sure that everyone does what they're supposed to and that all the transactional documents are completed properly? So that introduces the concept of a transaction manager, designated by the managing broker because he's got a conflict. He can't manage the transaction and close the transaction if he's representing one of the parties. So he still has responsibility, but he farms out that supervision of the transaction to somebody else called a transaction manager. And so the one I kind of like to illustrate it is a three-cornered real estate firm where there's a broker and two salesmen. If the two salesmen, if one of them lists the property for on behalf of the seller, one salesman, and then a buyer comes in and the other salesman then becomes a designated agent for the buyer, everything's pretty cool. You've got the broker overseeing it, You've got a designated agent for the seller. You've got a designated agent for the buyer. They're both in the same office, but that's okay. The broker oversees it, makes sure everyone does their job, manages the transactional documents, and gets the deal closed. That's pretty good. But it may be that when the seller came in originally to list the property, it was listed with the broker. So the two salesmen are now available, and then the buyer comes in and one of the salesmen establishes a relationship with the buyer. So now we have the broker as the designated agent for the seller, and we have one of the salesmen as the designated agent for the buyer. What are we going to do about managing the transactional aspect of the sale? So the broker cannot do it, but he can designate the other salesman. If he doesn't like the other salesman or feels that the other salesman doesn't have sufficient experience, he can designate somebody else as the transaction manager, and he is responsible for the actions of that transaction manager. But he has to appoint somebody that's not a party to the deal to oversee the closing and the preparation and signing of documents and recording and all those things that go on. Now, there's one more thing that goes on in here that's a little bit different, and that is it limits the vicarious liability of the seller and the buyer. And that goes back to a fundamental tenet of the law of agency, that a principal is liable for all the acts of his agent. And ordinarily, those are only the acts of his agent that the agent's authorized to perform. If the agent gets outside the scope of his authority, then there's no vicarious liability. But there is another little twist in there called apparent authority, which says that if a principal puts an agent in a position where it's apparent or appears to the public reasonably that that agent has authority to do what he's doing, then the principal may be liable for that. That exposes buyers and sellers to more liability, vicarious liability for their agent, their seller's agent or buyer's agent, than we like. And it's not good. And so there is some limitation of vicarious liability in the bill. So with that, I will answer any questions if there are any questions on the big picture. And if there aren't, I will work my way through the bill with you as fast as I can. And seeing no one at the podium, that is what I'll do. Page 2, actually starting on page 1 at the bottom, we talk about customers, which is another concept. Some people do not want to have an agent. They want to be in a real estate transaction, but they don't want to have an agent. They're a seller, they don't want to have an agent. They're a buyer, they don't want to have an agent. They just want to work with a realtor. So they're considered to be a customer. And a realtor owes certain duties toward a customer, and those start at the top of page 2, and they run on through to line 4 on page 5. And that defines all of the duties of a licensee working with a buyer or seller who's a customer. Then on page 5, at line 5, there is a specific little section in here about what happens when licensees are working with landlords and tenants. And it says that for purposes of this article, a licensee, and we're going to call them now, we used to call them real estate agents, we call them a lot of things, now they're licensees. A licensee is deemed to be working with the landlord as an agent pursuant to a written agreement. And the tenant, who's a customer, unless otherwise provided in writing between the parties. So a real estate agent working with landlords and tenants, unless it's set up differently in writing, is an agent of the landlord, or can be an intermediary. But as to the tenant, they're working with them as a customer. That then takes us to page 4, line 6, and there are a number of definitions in there, and the biggest change that you'll find all the way through this is we change broker to licensee. And they do hold a real estate license, so that's a logical change. We do retain the definition of intermediary on page 6 at line 12, and we have a new definition to define a customer that's on page 7 beginning at line 5, means a party to a real estate transaction who has established no intermediary or agency relationship with any licensee in that transaction. We've already defined that there are still duties owed toward that person, but they have no agency relationship. Then we have the designated agent beginning on line 9 at page 7, and that's a licensee designated in writing by the responsible broker. So the responsible broker is overseeing this to serve as an agent or intermediary for either a seller or a buyer. Then we have the definition of an in-house real estate transaction, which is this internal thing that I talked about. We talk about who a licensee is. Line 22 on page 7, we talk about the responsible broker. That's the person that has the broker's license and who's been designated as the broker responsible for supervision of the licensee. Then we have... Well, where'd it go? Then we go to page 8, line 4, and that's the concept of a transaction manager. A licensee designated in writing by the responsible broker to supervise a transaction. And the transaction manager shall not be an agent in the transaction, and has the duties of an intermediary while supervising it, which means, as duties as an intermediary means to not withhold confidential information from either party and to fully disclose information that comes to his or her attention. Then we go, starting at line 10 on page 8, the relationship between a licensee and the public, and we have some new language in there that says, when engaged in real estate activities, a licensee may act in a real estate transaction as an agent or an intermediary and may work with the seller or the buyer as a customer. And so you might have this situation. I struggled with this a little bit. Maybe you have a seller's agent and you have a buyer who doesn't have an agent, but you have a buyer who's a customer. Well, then, working with the buyer as a customer, those, we've already been through that. There are certain defined duties that seller's agent has to the buyer when working with them as a customer. And that's somebody who comes in who just won't sign a listing agreement. And there are people like that, especially in ag transactions. There's a lot of that goes on where people won't sign a listing agreement, exclusive or otherwise, and they are just customers. That's the best that the real estate industry is going to do with them, and that's all they want. A lot of times they're a customer because they have an attorney and they're doing their own thing and they don't want a designated agent to work with them. Then we go to page 9, line 10, and we add a little bit of language there that says when engaged in real estate activities, a licensee may act as a sub-agent. And the duties of a sub-agent of another agent are set out already in the Act, only pursuant to written agreement between the seller and the seller's agent, authorizing sub-agency, or, and then we just add one little thing in there, as an intermediary with the seller or buyer, when the written agreement discloses that, and there's already a statutory definition of what an intermediary has to disclose to act in that capacity. Then there's some cleanup language on the rest of line 9. Line 10 is just some language changes until we get to line 14 on page 10. And here's the multiple licensees or multiple agents in one brokerage firm. If a firm has more than one licensee, the responsible broker and any licensee associated with him may be designated to work with the seller or the buyer as a designated agent. That gets two agents within the same real estate firm. And then for an in-house real estate transaction, the designated agent shall be a broker, an associate broker, or a salesman under the direct supervision of a broker who's not a party or a transaction manager. And then at line 9 on page 11, we set out the fact that licensees employed by the same responsible broker who's not acting as a designated agent for any party in a transaction may be designated agents for different buyers and sellers in the same transaction. And then that gets into the combination thing where they're selling, where they're showing different properties to somebody, one as a buyer's agent, one as a seller's agent. So you can imagine how that gets tangled up, where pretty soon the buyer's agent in one transaction is showing a property that's listed by the seller's agent in another capacity because it's a different owner. And so it works its way through that. Then we have an important provision that begins at line 23 on page 11. It says the licensee may work as an agent for the seller, treating the buyer as a customer, or an agent for the buyer, treating the seller as a customer, but not as an agent for both seller and buyer. And that is the essence of it. They may be designated to work as an intermediary for both the buyer and the seller in the same transaction. And we've been working with that for a while, and they all understand what that means, and they understand the duties they have of disclosure and not withholding confidential information when they're an intermediary. It says that beginning at line 4 on page 12, that these relationships have to be in writing and be put there at the earliest opportunity. And then we provide, beginning at line 7, a designated agent is not precluded with working with a buyer or seller in a real estate transaction solely because the agent was precluded from representing that person in an earlier separate real estate transaction. So sometimes they're going to switch hats here. Then we have this provision on vicarious liability at line 12 on page 12. No seller or buyer. Those are not the agents. These are the seller or the buyer. So be vicariously liable for an agent's acts or omissions that have not been approved directly or ratified by the seller or buyer. And that takes care of this troublesome area in the law of agency of apparent authority. Then line 16 on page 12, nothing in this section is construed to limit the responsible broker's responsibility to supervise licensees associated with the firm. Line 21, a licensee shall not establish dual agency with any seller or buyer. That would be where they're both a seller's agent and a buyer's agent. Cannot do that. Then on page 13, beginning at line 1, a customer relationship exists between a licensee and a party to a real estate transaction unless a single agency, which would be a designated agent for one or the other, that's a single agency, or an intermediary relationship is established through a written agreement. And when a buyer or seller is represented by another licensee, a licensee may work with the other buyer or seller as a customer without a written agreement but subject to the duties that are in this act. And then a provision there at line 8 on page 13, a licensee shall not owe any duty of confidentiality to a customer. And so it's more of the intermediary type of relationship. Then line 12 on page 13, the proprietary ownership interest of listings is vested with the responsible broker. Then from there, Madam Chairwoman, I think through the balance of the Act, is mostly technical language, technical corrections to the Act to recognize the fact that we changed the lingo in here from broker to licensee. We do have another provision on page 18 at line 8. For purposes of this section, open house showings, preliminary conversations, and requests for factual information do not constitute discussions or arrangements incidental to a sale, purchase, exchange, or lease. Because if they did, agency relationships begin to arise. And when they're sitting there having an open house, they just need to have a conversation. Then technical language. There is, always has been, protections on the relationship disclosure, and there's some enlargement of that on page 19, beginning at page 8, that says a statement. Has to be in writing that indicating that the seller or buyer may be vicariously liable for acts of their agent if they approve, direct, or ratify those acts, and a statement that a customer shall not be afforded any confidentiality in any commission. Boy, I'm getting tongue-tied. Communication in to or with a licensee. Then I think the rest of it is technical language changes. They do provide on page 20 at line 20 that both parties must execute a written agreement at the earliest reasonable opportunity after events creating a potential conflict in agency relationship exists. So if you have two people coming in and we're going to take off on this seller's agent and buyer's agent in the same real estate firm, then at the earliest opportunity, they have to get into a written agreement with those people. And that, I think, Madam Chairwoman, is probably enough, and I'll stand for any questions.
We are on the standing committee amendment, which has been moved. Is there any discussion on the standing committee amendment? Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I hesitate to ask, but could he explain the standing committee amendment before we vote on it?
Representative Brown.
I could if I hadn't lost it here. Thank you. They're coming from everywhere. The standing committee amendment on page 11, lines 9 through 12. I really did like this amendment. 9 through 12 replaces the language that's there and says licensees employed or engaged by the same responsible broker may be designated agents, and that's exactly what we've been saying, may be designated agents for different buyers or sellers in the same transaction. If the responsible broker is representing a buyer or a seller in an in-house transaction, the responsible broker shall immediately appoint a transaction manager. And that is the other party who's going to oversee the transaction who's not an agent for either the buyer or the seller. And that, before that standing committee amendment, this bill lacked any requirement to appoint a transaction manager. And this, it was sort of implied, but it didn't really say that, and this explicitly says it. So that is the standing committee amendment, Madam Chairwoman. If there's no questions on it, I'd call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The standing committee amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Is there further discussion? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I've seen these discussions and heard these discussions many times, and for the first time I can ever remember, I happen to be up the next bill up in the Judiciary Committee, all of those people that were there agreed that this was a very good piece of legislation. Before, they always were, this one was invading my territory, that was invading my territory. For the first time that I can ever remember, these people all said this was a very good piece of legislation, and I urge the body to adopt this piece of legislation as amended.
Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, I have a question on page 4, little b, where it talks about a licensee has no duty, and then down on line 4 it says to independently verify the accuracy or completeness of statements made by the seller. The reason I have a question about that is I knew a party that purchased a house, And the description of the house said it had so many square feet in it.
And after the seller had purchased the house and then later on measured it, found out that it didn't have as many square feet in it as what had been indicated, and went back to the realtor and I believe made a recovery from the realtor because they had misrepresented the property. How would that work now with this language in there?
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairwoman, notice that all of that language is in 3328.110, which concerns licensees working with buyers and sellers as customers and describes the duties and exceptions that are associated with working with an individual as a customer. So this is a situation that paragraph B applies to, where there is not a designated agency relationship with either the seller or the buyer. And B says there are certain things that under those circumstances the licensee doesn't have to do for the buyer. And C are certain duties that the licensee does not have to perform on behalf of the seller. And let's take C first. A licensee has no duty to conduct an independent investigation of the buyer's financial condition or to verify the accuracy or completeness of any statements made by the buyer. And that, so we take care of that on the one side. On the other side, with respect to the buyer, the licensee has no duty to conduct an independent inspection of the property for the benefit of the buyer, and no duty to independently verify the accuracy of any statements of the seller. Now, if that duty is going to come about and the licensee is going to be held to that duty, then that licensee should be an agent for either the seller verifying information coming from the buyer, financial sufficiency, or an agency from the buyer verifying information coming from the seller, like the one I always run into is leaking basements where that information has been withheld. And so this bill really splits up the law of agency and says if you're an agent for the buyer, you're going to do certain things on behalf of the buyer. If you're an agent for the seller, you're going to do certain things for the seller. If you're not an agent for either one of them, then you don't have the same obligations you would have if you were his designated go-to guy or gladiator or however, whatever euphemism we might use.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I won't bore you with how long I was in the real estate business as a broker and developer, but let me tell you that the good practices of a good agency are now embodied in this bill, and in particular the one where the licensee, as it's now called, the licensee cannot represent both the buyer and the seller. And there is a provision now that is statutorily supporting those good practices. Without going into any further detail, I urge the adoption of this measure.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 110 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 110 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Hales.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My good friend from Casper and your former colleague who led the fight for the removal of the tax from food and whose chair I'm using but certainly not filling is in the balcony, Ann Robinson.
Welcome back to the House.
Madam Chairman, I'm curious why her husband didn't introduce her.
Chairman Childers, would you like to further explain?
Madam Chair.
Excuse me.
Proceed.
Privilege of the floor.
Go ahead, Representative.
I just have to say that we are letting a couple suches through occasionally. We're trying to stop the suches representative, but certainly up in the Corporations Committee, we've got a couple of such filters.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee the whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion carries.
If there'd been
will the reading clerk please read the committee of the whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate File 8, Feral Livestock, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 36, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 4, recommended do pass. Senate File 22, recommended do pass. Senate File 19, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 7, recommended do pass. Senate File 25, recommended do pass. Senate File 61, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again. Senate File 113, recommended do pass. Senate File 31, recommended do pass. Senate File 117, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 21, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 86, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 70, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 29, recommended do pass. Senate File 11, recommended do pass. Senate File 58, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 110, amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Edmonds, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Thank you, Representative Edmonds. We're at that order of business of signing of enrolled acts. The reading clerk will read the enrolled act.
Enrolled Act number 4, being original House Bill number 55, an act relating to courts authorizing the Wyoming Supreme Court to determine the resident of circuit court judges, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign enrolled Act number 4, being original House Bill number 55. I have so signed. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 103, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. No, Mercer. Signed, Representative Mercer, Vice Chair. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred Senate File 130, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred Senate File 17, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart, sign representing Berger, chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two appropriations, to whom is referred Senate File 32 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart, sign representing Berger, chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two appropriations, to whom is referred Senate File 75 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Ammons, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart, sign representing Berger, chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number four, Education, to whom is referred Senate File 46, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubnow, McKim, McCombie, Teeters, sign representing McCombie, chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number seven, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 42, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Miller, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan, excused, Illaway, Lubnow, signed Representative Brown, Vice Chair. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred Senate File 132, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson, sign Representative Landon, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred Senate File 137, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson, sign Representative Landon, Chairman.
Are there any re-referrals? Chairman Landon.
No re-referral, but a meeting notice.
Committee announcements. Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, will meet tomorrow on recess to hear Senate File 92, Long-Term Care Access. We will meet next on Tuesday morning at 8:30 to work Senate File 54, Physical Therapist Licensure.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet at 4:30 tonight, February 12th, Thursday, in room H-17 to discuss Senate File 38 engrossed, Real ID compliance, and Senate File 59, road closure.
Chairman McCombie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet upon noon recess tomorrow in H-10 to take up Senate File 23 engrossed, Accelerated Nursing Degree Loan Repayment Program.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Friday morning at 7:30 H-18 to consider Senate Joint Resolution 5, Hydraulic Fracturing, and Senate File 85, Cooperative Electric Utility Rate Regulation.
That was easy.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, I am reading off of a script, and I won't talk off-cuff anymore. Your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Friday morning, February the 13th at 8 a.m. in H-10 to consider Senate File 16 engrossed state butterfly. And if time allows, we'll consider Senate File 6, Wyoming Arts Council revisions, and Senate File 14, State Historic Site Appropriation.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Revenue Committee number 3 is so efficient we will not meet tomorrow morning.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet immediately upon adjournment in our regular room to take up working on Senate File 95, Medical Necessity Review Procedures, and Senate File 62, Discretionary Clause Prohibition Act, and we are taking tomorrow off, and we will be back on Tuesday, 8 a.m., to take up Senate File 140, drug court funding, and Senate File 84, aggravated assault choking.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Mr. Speaker, the Republican caucus will meet in 302 at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. The source of the fire alarm today was drilling of a conduit hole for electrical wiring and some furniture in 302. They didn't know what it was, so they evacuated the building. The fire department was quite appreciative of the orderly evacuation, and it made it very easy for them to come in and inspect and find out what was going on. So thanks for your cooperation today. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, did well today on general file, and as you can see, tomorrow is very manageable, but we may not get to general file. The schedule will be to do a third reading on the budget first, and then hopefully we'll have time to get through second reading, but I want to get through that first. So hopefully, if all goes well, we can get you out of here at a decent time for the long weekend. So that's the plan for tomorrow. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until Friday the 13th, February 13th, 2009 at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Motion is carried. We are adjourned until tomorrow morning. You will have a packet of budget amendments out on your desk shortly. There will still be amendments coming out, but you will receive a packet of the amendments to date.